What we're talking about is late night and early morning low clouds. With a chance of fall, chance of showers into the afternoon, with variable high cloudiness and gusty winds. Gusty winds at times around the corner of Sunset and Alvarado. Yeah, I know, things are tough all over. When the thunderstorms start increasing over the southeast and south central portions of my apartment, I get upset. And a line of thunderstorms was developing in the early morning hours ahead of a slow-moving cold front. Cold-blooded. With tornado watches issued shortly before noon Sunday for the areas including the western region of my mental health and the northern portion of my ability to deal rationally with my disconcerting, precarious emotional situation. It's cold out there. Colder than a ticket taker's smile at the Ivor Theater on Saturday night. Flash flood watches cover the southern portion of my disposition. Yeah. There was no severe weather well into the afternoon.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the French Connection. And it is January 27th. My name is Daryl Smith. I am the witness. And we have a great show lined up for you today. Before we get started with our guest, Michael Kiefer, Professor Michael Kiefer, from Guelph, University of Guelph in Ontario, Canada, I'd like to read something to you to give you an idea of what the rest of the world is thinking about America right now. This is on MSNBC, and you can find it on their website. It's talks about the gulf between the Americans and the rest of the world. It says, the gulf between America's view of themselves and how the world views them was summed up in a poll last week by the BBC. Fully 71% of Americans see the United States as a source of good in the world. More than half view Bush election as positive for global security. Other studies report that 70% have faith in their domestic institutions, and nearly 80% believe America's ideas and customs should spread globally. Foreigners take an entirely different view. 58% of in the BBC poll see the Bush re-election as a threat to world peace. And among the traditional allies, the figure is strikingly higher. 77% in Germany, 64% in Britain, 82% in Turkey, and a full 79% in France. Among the 1.3 billion members of the Islamic world, public support for the United States is measured in single digits. Only Poland and the Philippines, India, viewed Bush's second inaugural as positively. Tellingly, the Bushism of the president's first term is giving way to a more general anti-Americanism. A plurality of voters, the average is 70% in each of the 21 countries surveyed by the BBC, oppose sending any troops to Iraq, including those of most of the countries that have done so. Only one-third, disproportionately the poorest and most dictatorial countries, would like to see American values spread to their country, says Doug Miller of Globalization Scan, which conducted the BBC report. President Bush has further isolated America from the world. Unless the administration changes its approach, it will continue to erode America's good name and hence its ability to effectively influence world affairs. Former Brazilian President Jose Sanare expressed the sentiment of the 78% of his countrymen who see America as a threat. Now that Bush has been reelected, all I can say is God bless the rest of the world. Ladies and gentlemen, we have lost our prestige. We have destroyed our standing. We do not any longer stand as the beacon on the planet, and we are no longer the envy of the world. And Mr. Bush, in his terrible policies, are destroying the quality that America once had. It's time that we stood up and be counted. I, for one, will be counted against this whole new world order. And we'll be back after the break with Mr. Michael Kiefer, and talk to you then.
We'll be right back.
back, ladies and gentlemen, and it's great to be with you again on the French Connection. Today's guest is Professor Michael Kiefer. But before we go to Professor Kiefer, I want to tell you that he wrote a wonderful expose on the voter fraud that took place in both Ohio and Florida, and he has got a great body of work that he's provided. But before we go to Professor Kiefer, we're going to take a call from Eric Schein. Eric, are you online with me?
How's it going?
Pretty good, Eric. What's up?
I just wanted to try to call in and touch base with you, and there's so much stuff I could go into. I mean, if people don't realize that there's something seriously wrong with this country right now, beyond the voter fraud, they need to wake up and wake up quickly. I wanted to touch base, too, and see about hopefully sometime in the future getting on your show.
This show, I would love to do an interview with you. In fact, and I have a lot of knowledge about the sea. I spent a lot of time in the United States Navy, and in fact, come from a area of the country where being on the ocean is a way of life. I'm from Narragansett Bay.
Nice.
And so, you know, the idea that I understand that's gone on is a travesty, and I would love to have you on my show. What I will do, Eric, is I have your phone number, and I will contact you and get you on as probably next week if you have the time.
Yeah, I'd appreciate that. And
well,
not take anything away from your current guest, but it's all interconnected. I mean, all the stuff that's going on is enormous. And people need to wake up quickly. 911, the voter fraud, the stuff that's going on with me, just, you know, across the nation. It's being stolen right out from underneath us. And people need to wake up quickly and get in, you know, into action now.
Well, you know something, the idea that I think what we need to do with RBN is to spread this network's reach, and we have to get the word out that this network is distributing the truth as best it can, because, you know, to try to go out and shake hands with people and tell them what's happening, you might be able to influence 5 or 10 people a day, but if you can get on this network and get it really rolling like it's possible that it could be, you know, pushed forward, I think we could touch millions. So,
yeah, we need to. I mean, and that's the only way it's going to happen.
Absolutely. Well,
absolutely.
Eric, I'll give you a call. I do have your number, and we'll do a show next week. So my listeners are probably going to look forward to having you on the show, and I'll get in touch with you much sooner than that, sir.
Thanks, and I look forward to trying to search down. Where can I actually get the book for your current guest?
Well, you can go to theglobalresearch.ca, www.globalresearch.ca, and actually he's written some other books. He's going to explain some of the other books he's written. Some of them are about some of the cultural degradations that have led to some of the problems we've got right now, and he's really a wonderful guy and an extraordinary researcher. So and I'm sure, I've never taken his class, but I'm sure he's a great professor too. So hopefully you listen to this broadcast and you'll get a little bit more information about Professor Kiefer.
Cool, and I thank you for having him on.
Well, thank you, sir.
Thanks.
I'll talk to you soon.
Take care.
Bye. So we'll go directly to Professor Michael Kiefer from the University of Guelph in Ontario, Canada. Are you with me, Professor Kiefer?
I am indeed, Dale.
Well, that's wonderful to talk to you. I read the article that you wrote. It's actually extensive. It's very long, and I can't say that I enjoyed it. I enjoyed your writing. But the information that I read, Michael, is disturbing, to say the least.
Well, it's disturbing. It's disturbing in that what it reveals is the theft of an election, not for the first time, of course. But I think, on the other hand, what it does also bring out, and I it might be worth emphasizing this at the start. And I'm thinking here of all of the researchers, the citizen activists, the scholars, the statisticians, the mathematicians who've been doing the work that I was surveying and trying to analyze. I think what that reveals is the enormous reservoirs of decency and of integrity in the American people.
I think you're right. And, you know, it's not just in America, though, because there seems to me from my contact with Michelle yesterday and you, there are a lot of Canadians up in the north there that are as worried and as equally committed to getting this word out. I mean, they feel threatened by this regime in some similar ways as the American public does.
Yeah, there's a lot of connectedness, a lot of affection. Maybe anecdotal for a moment. Some of my own family roots are in the United States. We got kicked out for being on the wrong side during the Revolution, but and had to bid farewell to the family farm in New Jersey. And I regret to say that my ancestors seem to have had a small distillery there as well, which we also had to give up.
Well, you should have brought that with you, I think, you know?
Well, just think, for 200 years, you know, whoever inherited the place has been enjoying the fruits of the distillery.
Well, there you go.
Still in the barn, you know.
Do you know something? I just listened today, and I don't want to digress too much here, because I want to get back to your book, your article. There is a connection between what's going on, in fact, in the British Crown. And this seems to be closely connected to almost a conspiracy of the British to retake a very powerful position in the world. And there's some evidence that they're part and parcel of this whole movement to undermine the United States. I got to be honest with you, and it's coming. The evidence is pretty. Pretty important that I've looked at under Cecil John Rhodes' work and their roundtable structure and the CFR. I mean, a lot of this stuff was thought up in Britain.
Well, I'll be a skeptic on that, Darrell. That's my general orientation is to be highly skeptical. I think if one's doing trying to do research in these areas, one has to be.
Well,
show me the evidence, and I'll look at it.
Well, there is quite a body of evidence, especially if you start looking at the Billenberger group, and you start talking about the influence of the British Rothschild dynasty and the work that they've done to try to undermine the United States in the 1913 Federal Reserve Act, and the people that are controlling most of our money are done through a consortium that comes through Britain, in fact. And I mean that's not in debate, in fact. But I mean, let's go back to this voting mess that we seem to find ourselves in. And one of the reasons that I thought it would be a great interview is because I can't understand why this is not getting traction in the American, even the American alternate press. It seems like they're even starting to drop this off their radar screen. Can you explain that when you were doing your research? Well, why this doesn't seem to be getting picked up even by alternative anymore?
Well, it doesn't get picked up by the corporate press, I think, for pretty obvious reasons.
Yeah.
That most of the corporate press is owned by large conglomerates who find it to be to their benefit to have a corrupt government in power that will allow them to concentrate media holdings and multiply their profits even more than they've been able to do in the past. So I think although there are without question many fine investigative journalists who have been working on the story, they've tended to be able to publish their work only in alternative media sources. I'm thinking here, for example, of the wonderful work done by Bob Fatrakis and his colleagues at the Columbus Free Press. In terms of the alternative media, I think in some cases there's a kind of perhaps it's a kind of fear that comes with the thought that one may be living in a time of really serious historical discontinuities. I think one analogy, it may seem hackneyed to bring it up, but an analogy might well be with the way people in Germany were thinking in the early 1930s. This can't be happening. If you look into the historical records, there you see a lot of that. People thinking,
Do you think that's the principal explanation for why some Americans are just either discounting this or just, I mean, first of all, see,
I think people find it hard to credit, for example, that their democracy could be menaced in the way that it obviously is. I mean, if one looks at the evidence, it is I think absolutely the cumulative evidence points pretty unambiguous.
I think it's beyond menaced. I think it's just, I think it's flat out has been taken. It's gone.
Well, there's the problem. When you have the corporate media collaborating with what has become effectively a one-party state, which controls the executive branch, in a fairly militarized society.
So let's call it what it is, Michael. We live in a dictatorship right now. Let's call a spade here, say that we live in a single party dictatorship.
When you have the Senate, the House, the judiciary, the presidency, controlled by a single party. And I think it's worth remembering that little episodes that have been kind of conveniently flushed down the memory hole, like the terrorist anthrax attack that followed the 9/11 event in the autumn of 2001, nobody was ever caught. That was quite clearly an attempt to scare hell out of the Senate.
It certainly worked, and they ended up moving that stuff all over the different buildings. Will you hold on with me, Michael? We'll pick up our conversation after the break.
Sure.
Ladies and gentlemen, stay with me. We've got lots more to come from Professor Michael Kiefer on the subject of the death of the American democracy endgame in Hawaii and Ohio. And we're back, ladies and gentlemen, with more great Talk Radio. My name is Daryl Smith, and you are listening to The French Connection. And we have on our line here today Professor Michael Kiefer. We've been talking about the voter fraud. He wrote an incredibly in-depth and concise report on the theft of this particular election. Michael, when we were talking yesterday, you talked to me about some of the other people that were involved in working on this, such as Bev Harris and whatnot, and you just mentioned earlier that a lot of the work you were citing for the statistics part is coming from other places. Can you elaborate on some of the information
that you were able
to put in?
Yeah, I mean, there are people. There's a very fine scholar, Dr. Stephen Freeman at the University of Pennsylvania, the Center for Organizational Dynamics at the University of Pennsylvania, who has done some, I think, very important work analyzing the exit poll issue, which is, of course, one of the crucial things. Here you have a government that, rightly enough, makes an international fuss when there's evidence in late November that the second round presidential elections in Ukraine were corrupt. And what's the evidence? The evidence is a big divergence between the vote tally and the exit polls.
Isn't the hypocrisy amazing?
Well, the joke in that case is that of the exit polls in Ukraine, the one that seems to be, by what I can gather, the more reliable one, shows that second round presidential election was stolen by exactly 6.2%. Now, when you turn to the state of Ohio, the exit poll in Ohio deviates from, or rather the vote tally deviates from the exit poll results by exactly 6.2%.
Oh boy.
And that was the swing state of swing states.
Well, you mentioned to me, Michael, that we actually had the reporting consortium kind of made a mistake. They actually did some reporting early on in the election process that some of the stuff was coming out, and you said you were able to trap some of that early information before they were able to go backwards on it and delete it, in fact, or change the results. What did you find when you did that?
Well, that's actually what got me started on this. I was looking at the CNN website on November 2nd on the evening and taking note of the exit poll data. And I checked it again the next morning and noticed that the figures had all changed. Now, what happens with exit poll data is, of course, there's raw material from the exit poll workers who are scattered, of course, across the state, or in the national exit poll, which sampled something over 13,000 people nationwide, all across the country. What they have to do is to weight those figures, because they deliberately try to get, in order to have a statistically significant sample, say, of minority voters or Hispanic women voters, for example, that they'll try and get a larger than proportional sample of those people, and then they weight it according to the number of those people who were actually kind of at the polls, as best they can figure that out. Now, the figures that were published that were on the CNN website on the evening of Election Day were those weighted figures. In other words, that was the best shot of the very professional, very experienced exit poll professionals as to what the likely outcome of the election was going to be. What they did the next morning, whether it's some kind of corruption or why exactly they did it, I don't know. But what they did was to conflate those figures with the vote tallies, which means that what was published on the morning of November 3rd and since on the CNN website as the exit poll data is actually not exit poll figures at all. It's the exit poll figures mixed in with the vote tallies, so that in effect the figures have been made to agree with the vote tallies.
You know, one of the things that's happened since then, and then you pointed out in your article about this guy Blackwell and some of the obfuscation, some of the blocking, and
the Secretary of State in Ohio.
Oh my goodness, this guy is a criminal. I mean, he's going against Ohio state law. He's broken, I guess, almost every regulation that he was sworn to uphold, as far as allowing legal counting and having challenges made. And the idea that the state of Ohio would be sleeping on this one is a scary thought to me. And I'm wondering what in your research, maybe to pick out the most important error that he made, maybe in your research, and that what you were able to find when you looked at this, the way he suppressed the information from coming out correctly.
Oh well, there's dirty fingerprints all over the place, and I mean it's obviously not just one man. Although he clearly had a crucial position as Secretary of State, he was basically running the electoral machinery in Ohio. Well, they purged the electoral rolls, the list of registered voters, before the election. And that comes through in a really sickening way when you look at...
Well, what's the result? When you purge an election roll, what is the result of that in the election process?
Well, what they were doing was to get principally African-American and Hispanic voters, but African-American voters off the list. So they wouldn't get a chance to vote, or if they did, they'd have to use the provisional ballot.
Well, we're going to pick this up on the other side of this next break. We have a nice long period coming up. We're going to be talking much more in depth with Professor Kiefer about this most important subject. Be right back with you, ladies and gentlemen. For the second half of our program here, I want to thank my listeners for tuning in today. You can contact me at iamthewitness@hotmail.com with any questions about our guest's interview, or you can actually go to the website that our guest, Mr. and Professor Michael Kiefer, has written a wonderful article. It's been distributed with the Global Research in Canada, www.globalresearch.ca. You can read the entire article. It is in depth. It is probably the most in depth and complete reporting of this most important of problems the Americans are facing right now that I've ever read. And so, Michael, we want to continue for a minute. I got to the part of your article here with where you started actually categorizing and here we go. We're talking about the you made a list. It says the fraud list here. It goes down the list: uncounted punch cards, fraud through default. You went down the list, and you've put it all out there for anybody to see. What do you think the reason is that no one's picking this up in a legal sense? Is it out of fear, or have they completely corrupted the judicial process that we have in place to stop this? Have you been able to glean any kind of
I think it's the latter. I mean, there's some fearless lawyers out there, including Mr. Arnebeck and Mr. Fedrakis and their colleagues in Ohio who challenged the results there in the courts. The problem, of course, is that in Ohio, the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, Thomas Moyer, refused to recuse himself from a case in which he was actually involved because there were questions asked in the initial filing about the legitimacy of his own re-election. He went ahead nonetheless and judged that case.
And what was his judgment?
His initial judgment was simply to throw it out. He said you can't combine two issues, one involving my election and one involving Bush's election.
Has this died in the courts over there? Are there still the Ohioans still fighting it?
It has effectively died. What's happened most recently is that the Ohio Republicans are going after the lawyers who dared to challenge Blackwell. They're attempting to punish them for having stood up and said, look, this election was stolen. So that may go through the courts, and let's hope that'll get a little bit of media attention.
Well, so basically they're using intimidation and dirty dealing here to suppress anybody's outrage even. And did you look into? I mean, I read through this, so I'm going to ask you: do you make any parallels with the Florida fraud, or did you find a link between these two groups? I mean, were they communicating? Yeah. Were there people, bad guys in the background, going, "How you doing in Orlando? What's going on down there in Miami?" Or was this really compartmentalized?
I think that it must have been centrally operated. I mean, that how exactly is, of course, anyone's guess. But at the beginning of the article, I quote that outrageous statement by Republican Congressman Peter King, who was interviewed in the garden of the White House on the afternoon of November 2nd, Election Day, and informed his interviewer that it's already over. He said, the election's over, we won. And the interviewer, of course, wondered how he knew so early in the day. And he said, it's all over but the counting, and we'll take care of the counting. So they clearly did. I think that it looks pretty obvious that was done nationally. I mean, there's a lot of statistics that I didn't make space for in the article that you've read. But if one looks, for example, and statisticians have looked at this, in particular people publishing at the Democratic Underground website, for example, voting irregularities reported per capita of state population.
Yeah,
and it seems that the dirtiest election, state election on November 2nd was in Arizona.
Really?
7.3 times more voting irregularities per capita than the national average. Georgia, 7 times the national average.
So Arizona what kind of irregularities are we talking about here?
Oh, this would be all kinds of things. These would be people complaining about default settings on touchscreen machines. So you press a vote for one candidate. I mean, in this case, all of the accounts that have been published have indicated that it was people trying to vote for Kerry who found the machine had given their vote to Bush. That's been dismissed as, you know, the kind of thing that maybe the checkout machine in the supermarket might do. It might charge you too much for a head of lettuce. And the computer security experts say no, that's preset default settings. Those machines don't do that because they're having a hissy fit. They do it because That's what they've been told to do. That's what they've been programmed to do.
You know, one of the interesting things that I've been looking at also, and you pointed this out, and I'd like to make this connection. We talked yesterday in our private conversation about what was going on in New Mexico, and there was a lot of evidence of voter fraud and voter intimidation and voter problems in New Mexico. Here's the interesting thing that you pointed out, and I found in my own research, that was actually seems to have been precipitated by the opposite party in some ways. Can you elaborate on a little bit maybe what you kind of suspect in that case?
That's bizarre, but one does find, I mean, the two major American parties have sometimes been described as kind of one big bird with two right wings. If you think of people like Senator Joe Lieberman, who ran as Al Gore's running mate in 2000.
He's a neocon, this guy.
There are Democrats who are in some ways indistinguishable from Republicans. My guess would be that those people
Governor Richardson, I think he has some designs on national public office, maybe, or
that's quite possible.
Yeah, and I've heard his name thrown around. And do you think maybe they threw him a bone and said, you know, play ball with us this time, and maybe we'll get you on the ballot for the Democrats next time? Or
Your guess is as good as mine.
Well,
yeah, could be.
There was a lot of shenanigans in New Mexico, and in fact, any one of those states could have swayed the election for Kerry. But I don't think it would have mattered much, actually, because I think it would Kerry again the two right wings of a big bird here. I think it was a done deal in advance. I think Kerry took the dive. In fact, did you find out any information going back as far as the nominating process as to how Kerry was positioned to take that nomination in the first place?
No, that's not something I've looked into in detail.
But I suspect that was intentional as well.
I'm not sure. I'll be skeptical. I disagree very strongly with some of the positions that Kerry took, in particular his support for the Iraq War. That's without question by international law and by the law of the United States that war of aggression is criminal, and it was, I think, I'm sure, deeply disappointing to large numbers of American voters that the Democratic Party didn't give them a candidate who was willing to stand up against that war. Kerry has, in many respects, I think, a very honorable record. I admire his courage as a young man in 1971, standing up and saying, look, I took part in the Vietnam War, and this is what I saw. I mean, that I think is a very, that was a very courageous.
But then there's a sickening part to that he knows he's just sent another generation of boys to go do the same kind of fighting that he so decried. And so to me, that kind of hypocrite, that kind of swapping of sides here is unconscionable from somebody who maybe started out with that kind of moral compass. And I think his compass has completely been twisted around here.
It's sad. Yeah.
I mean, beyond my imagination. We also talked yesterday, and this is, I'm going to make a little plug. I don't have your book. But you wrote a book, and it actually pointed out some interesting things. Then when we were talking privately, you mentioned that, you know, there's some interesting stuff that you got out of writing your book that maybe kind of points to socially there some of the stuff behind the problems we're facing right in America right now. You want to share with my listeners?
I did write a book. I wrote in, this was published, no, it's not, certainly not fresh news, that's why I'm a little hesitant.
Well,
in 1996, Lunar Perspectives, Field Notes from the Culture Wars.
Yeah.
Dealt with what was very clearly happening at that point, which was a kind of rerun of McCarthyism, a kind of an attempt by the hard right wing to crush critical opposition, in particular in the American university system, but there's very strong evidence of a very clearly thought out and capably executed plan worked out by right-wing and Republican strategists in the 1970s to put themselves into kind of unassailable control.
You're talking about all the way back into Nixon and Kissinger time.
Yeah, it goes. I mean, the foundations that have been funding right-wing pundits, so that it becomes really a very profitable business to crank out sort of neoconservative schlock. There are foundations that will provide people with cushy resources and salaries and research grants, and when their books do appear, they'll be heavily pumped in the press and so on.
Well, that's
the kind of stuff I was looking at.
What I've been able to see, Michael, to continue with that same thought, is that, you know, they graduated somehow during the 80s and 90s from just writing and maybe promoting their ideas to putting some teeth in these organizations and actually now turning those organizations into attack dogs. And now they're sending them out with some vicious bites to them, and evidenced in what they're doing to the people fighting in Ohio, evidenced, you know, across the country, where if you speak out today, you might lose a research grant, you might lose a tenured position, you might have somebody set you up for a crime, and in the instances of some of the other researchers across the country, we've actually got some rational and reasonable evidence that people have actually been taken out, put out, killed. And you can take a look. I mentioned yesterday to you about the bio researchers across the country, and where there's just it's like a 2 million to 1 or 2 billion to 1 possibility that this many bio researchers would be dead of these kind of things. And so what I'm saying is that they've made this assault grow some serious teeth. Yeah.
Yeah,
and I'm wondering
what you
suspect looking forward we could see coming. I mean, I hate to make put people on the spot with speculation, but you know, you're a learned man and you've looked into this pretty deeply. What do you suspect our next big mess is going to be, or give me a kind of window into what your thinking is?
Well, I think what the Bush Republicans have demonstrated is that they have put themselves into a position of unassailable power. They're not going to be dislodged through the kind of electoral process that we saw happen in November. And they're committed to a pretty alarming international adventurism. They've announced that they will feel free to carry out unprovoked aggression against basically any country that doesn't have the strength to resist in a significant way, that they will help themselves to whatever share of the world's declining energy resources they feel appropriate.
More adventurism in foreign. Well, what do you see?
There's also and coupled with that is a kind of economic adventurism. The financing of these adventures through incessant borrowing, the way in which the American economy has been kind of hollowed out, so that it rests very largely on, it seems, on a kind of enormous dollar printing confidence trick.
The United States
prints dollars and gets
it's a Ponzi scheme, Michael. And you know what?
Yeah.
The gig is up on this. I got to tell you, We've got some reports from very, very respected economists across the world who are actually very alarmed, and they don't think this is going to stay afloat for much longer.
Domestically, I think what's alarming is that first the Bush Republicans quite clearly have no respect for the traditions of American democracy. They have, in the First and Second Patriot Act, basically gutted the American Constitution. The newly appointed Attorney General, Alberto Gonzalez, is a man who is on record as legitimizing the practice of torture.
Well, now, do you know also, I've got one other thing to ask you. Did you know that they've hired the Stasi's chief to be the second, one of the main thinkers behind Homeland Security? His name is Wolf.
It's in no way surprising. But in terms of, just to touch for a moment on that issue of torture, if you think about how the Fifth Amendment to the American Constitution came into being, that came out of historical experience in Renaissance and the sort of Enlightenment age Europe, where torture until the Enlightenment, until the 18th century, was routinely practiced. People, you know, if you were arrested on kind of whether it was a crime of heresy or witchcraft or other kinds of crimes, in many countries in Europe, the automatic thing to do with the suspect is torture. And the Fifth Amendment was put in precisely to ensure that kind of violation of humanity didn't occur.
Well, we're heading down that slope again. I'm gonna ask you, everybody, to hold over for the final segment of our show. And we'll pick up from there with our Professor Michael Kiefer. Hold on, guys, and I'll be right back with you. After the break, ladies and gentlemen, I have had a wonderful time speaking with our guest, Professor Michael Kiefer. Professor Kiefer, you know, one of the problems with doing an hour-long show is it just flies by so quick. And
it does indeed, Daryl.
Wasn't it fast?
You've been very cunning. You've lured me away from the areas that I've researched most intensely, this electoral fraud business, into venturing comments on a wider area of issues.
Well, you know, it's important for my listeners, okay, I have an idea that America's got to wake up and start getting this fight back into we've got to take the country back, Michael. And you know, I'm worried, fearful about Canada, from America, Mexico. I mean, look, the world is at risk right now, and it's every human being on this planet should be up in arms about what they see going on in America.
Well, a lot of people are, when I've been recently to academic conferences in the United States, on Renaissance literature, by the way, that's what I do mostly. I'll be going off this afternoon to teach Shakespeare and Christopher Marlowe and things like that in my classes. But when I go to conferences like that, what people talk about is you know, these crazies, these people who have usurped power, who are doing criminal, idiotic, undemocratic things, who are violating the traditions of decency and integrity in the United States. I think, though, just to buck you up a little bit, give you some encouragement, you'll come across people, feisty Republicans, like there's a computer security expert named Chuck Herron. He's got a website, chuckherron.com. Mm-hmm. That's really worth going to, because he's working away on this election fraud issue.
Yeah.
And when it comes to questions about how the computer hacking was done. He's an expert. That's what he does for a living. He's got a company that works on behalf of corporations afraid of being hacked into, and he says, okay, let's go to work. And he hacks into their system, and then he shows them how to protect their system from hackers. So he knows exactly what was done.
See, the problem here is that they've already done it. Nobody's up in arms about it. So I can already tell you right now, in the next election cycle, it's just going to be more of it, or it's just actually going to be expanded. The fact is that there's a large body of the American populace that is not waking up to this truth. And until they do, I have few or little hope that we're going to be able to mount any resistance against what these I'm going to call them what they are, monsters, have done. And I'm worried, you know. I mean, I do this broadcast because I love my country and I have great hopes for the world. Michael, I thank you with all my heart for being on this show today.
Thank you for having me as your guest, Darrell. It's been a pleasure.
It was really great.
With you.
And you know what? I'm going to contact you privately just to have a quick talk with you at some point in the future.
That'll be fun.
Thank you, sir. Ladies and gentlemen, I want to thank you again for being with me today on the French Connection, and I want to tell you that I have great hopes for our nation, but we have to fight now. It's crunch time, guys. Stand up and be counted, please. And I'll talk to you guys tomorrow on another installment of my show. Thank you, and goodbye.